Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This could have been avoided if we followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio. To hell with them.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
This is Armageddon. This is a very big deal.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, and welcome to State of the Union Tuesday. Yes, the big speech is tonight, and we're all anticipating a great speech from the president. Of course, last year, he didn't give a State of the Union, but he did give an address to the joint session of Congress, of the House and the Senate, and he gave a really great speech. So it's going to be interesting to see what he does tonight, especially since the Democrats have supplied him with so many illegal aliens in the room. Is President Donald Trump going to mention all of those so-called dreamers who are sitting there in the chamber listening? It should be interesting to find out. Anyway, welcome to Tuesday. It is the Radio Northwest Network, and it's Honestly Provocative Talk for the Pacific Northwest. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-A-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. By the way, this hour we're giving away our second pair of tickets to the special screening of 1517 to Paris. It is the story of three young American heroes, real heroes in real life, who are on board a train in Paris. They was on his way from Amsterdam to Paris, and they managed to disarm a gunman who was in that train, a jihadi, and they took him down. They were unarmed. He was armed, but they were the heroes of the day. We'll give away another pair of tickets this hour. We only have 10 pair of tickets because this is a very exclusive screening on February the 9th at 6:30 in the evening at Cinetopia in Vancouver. And we'd be glad to give the tickets, but we want to make sure people make use of them. There were quite a few phone calls yesterday. We'll do that a little bit later on this hour. But let's start with this. Should we add health care as a constitutional right at the state level? Believe it or not, there are folks who announced yesterday from, what else, the Democrat Party, that they want voters to decide in the fall whether Oregonians, there's no companion measure for Washington state yet, but just wait, whether or not you have a constitutional right to health care. Kate Brown and Democrat lawmakers said, oh, we're so glad that the voters have passed a third of $1 billion in new taxes, and now they want to keep the spotlight on health care by asking voters to make it a right enshrined in the Oregon Constitution. Now, I think this is a huge mistake. There are lots of things that people have to have to be able to live in today's modern society. Housing is something you have to have, but housing is not a constitutional right. Food is an even more basic necessity. And yet, would you put food as a constitutional right in the state constitution? Would you put water in the constitution as a constitutional right? And I'm not being picky-oon. I'm suggesting that these are the kinds of things that you need to have, but they are not things that you put in the Constitution. Because what would be the meaning of it if you put it in the Constitution? You see, I have a right to vote that's in the state Constitution. I have a right to express myself, and that's in the state Constitution. But the state isn't going to pay for any of that. So to say that I have a right to health care, but who's going to pay for it? Having the right to have something, if the Constitution then suggests that there are Democrats who can use that constitutional right to say, well, now that we've guaranteed it to every person in the state, now it's on the state to pay for it. Because having it guaranteed as a right without having the payment to actually buy that service doesn't really make any sense. And if you were going to add something to the state constitution that was a necessity and also a constitutional right, would you start with health care? Or would you start with food, with shelter, with heat, with water, all of which, well, let's put it this way. In the Pacific Northwest in the wintertime, you're not going to live too long without shelter. You're not going to live for more than a couple of weeks without food. You're not going to live with more than a week or so without water. So wouldn't you make those constitutional rights? But if you do, you then begin to suggest that it's the state's job, your fellow taxpayers, to go out and buy those things for you. I don't think that makes any sense, but they're apparently planning to put it on the ballot. Should be fun to ask people like Kate Brown. So if it's a constitutional right, who ends up paying for everybody else to get it? Because remember, we can't all ride in the wagon. Somebody has to pull. And these days, even in these good economic times of the Trump economy, you're seeing more and more people riding in the wagon, and that means fewer and fewer people who are pulling on that wagon. Anyway, glad to have you with me. Glad to take your phone calls and emails. Our Twitter poll today, and I'm going to frame this in the language of the people who are suggesting this, although I don't agree with them. Should schools with the names of slave owners get new names? There is a neighborhood association that wants Jefferson High School in North Portland to be renamed, and they want people to be able to decide on this. Do you think it makes sense? Because the attack is specifically because Jefferson High School is named after President Thomas Jefferson, and they think his name should be taken off the school because he's a man who owned slaves, although Jefferson wanted the practice of slavery ended. And so should we in today's day and age say that because the way that Jefferson lived his life all those hundreds of years ago was not acceptable by today's standards, that his name should be taken off that school? You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, on my website at LarsLarson.com. And while you're on the website, check out the new challenge coins. We made these challenge coins as a way to honor the United States military because the military has challenge coins, and I've received so many of them. In fact, I received some more at SHOT Show last week, and I wanted a way to pay that back. And a little bit later on this hour, we will be giving out our second pair of tickets to the special screening of the 1517 to Paris, Clint Eastwood's new movie about three American heroes in which the real-life heroes play their own roles in the movie. We'll get to all of that in your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold, hard facts from Lars.
The voters of the Northwest keep choosing wimpy liberals for local jobs in office who never tire of proposing ways to make it easier for criminals. Last year, lawmakers decriminalized cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine. Liberals see drug crimes as minor and victimless. Now consider Sarah Zagul, a pretty girl murdered, her body parts stuffed into two suitcases and left to rot in a car. Her suspected killer, well known to the cops and the courts, Jeremiah Johnson, already had a felony rap sheet 2.5 years ago when he was caught with Oregon's new victimless crime drugs, coke, smack, and meth, and a gun. Now, you'd think that that gun in the hands of a convicted felon would have put Johnson away for a good long time, but he only got 23 months. Released from prison last year, he immediately went back to drugs, got caught, and then pleaded guilty. Yet all he got in September was probation, which left him free just a few months later to allegedly butcher Sarah Zagul. But remember, the lesson here is that drug crimes, according to the Democrats who are running things, are not serious crimes. And even in a gun-hating state like Oregon, a felon with a gun will not get serious time behind bars.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran-owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
Well, today's Daily Grill, it has gone to him a couple of times before, goes to Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. As my friend Dave Lister wrote in, Wheeler finally gets a backbone. Does he get tough on Antifa? No. Did he get tough on downtown panhandlers? No. Does he get tough on people who disrupt city council meetings? No. Does he get tough on the protesters who terrorized his family at his own home? No. He gets tough on President Donald Trump. Big whoop, big profile and courage. The Daily Grill to Ted Wheeler. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Comes in from Leroy, listening in Port Orchard, Washington, listening to Talk Radio 570 KVI. Lars, I have my radio on all night tuned to KVI. This morning I woke up at 6:30 and I heard John Carlson report that Maria Cantwell, senator, is inviting an illegal alien to the State of the Union address tonight as her guest. This person has been in the United States for 25 years and is an agitator against our laws. You probably can get more information about it than I have. This is disgusting for Senator Cantwell to do. I just called Cantwell's office and left a very pointed message about my feelings. I will also send an email. Please make this one of your stories today. Cantwell is spitting in the face of every law-abiding person in the state to do this, and ask your listeners to call her office and express their disappointment and disgust. Maybe if she gets enough calls before the State of the Union address, she will change her mind. Thank you, Lars. Always have great shows and great information. Signed, Leroy in Port Orchard. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment at 866-439-5277. Answer our Twitter poll question today. Should schools with the names of slave owners get new names? Should health care be added to the state constitution as a right? And in a moment, should we taxpayers fund a free attorney for anyone who loses a family member to a police officer-involved shooting? We'll talk about that as well. At 866-439-5277, you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a State of the Union Tuesday. A little bit later on this hour, we'll give away that pair of tickets to the 1517 to Paris, our special premiere screening of a great movie at the Cinetopia. And boy, Cinetopia has offered us their premier theater to watch it in. Only 38 people will be seated in there, and boy, is it plush, and I'll be there. Tina and I will be there to host this showing of Clint Eastwood's great new movie, which features the real-life heroes in their real-life roles. So, to your emails and your phone calls. Somebody just suggested, after hearing my argument against making health care a constitutional right, he said maybe we can make vacations and holidays a constitutional right as well, which makes no sense at all. And you're right. 866-439-5277. Let's go to Chris in Seattle, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. How you doing, Chris?
Great, Lars. Great job.
Thank you,
Thanks
sir.
For all you do.
My pleasure.
So I've been thinking along these lines lately, you know, with our lovely Sleepy Jay Inslee governor and our part-time Attorney General Bob Ferguson, and they all are deciding which laws they want to follow. I think that should apply to us citizens. You know, there's lots of laws that I'm not happy with, so I'm not interested in following the HOV lane laws or stop signs or, you know, getting my cats, all of that. If they can decide that, then so can we.
I think that's good logic, because it does begin to degrade the respect for law. And I've mentioned 100
right.
times, Chris, that there are lots of laws that are inconvenient for me, troublesome for me, costly for me, and I'm sure the same is true for you. So are we free as citizens to pick six or eight of those that we really don't like, the ones that cost us the most time or money, and simply say, I'm excused from following that law?
Sure. I mean, you know, once you ignore one law, then they're all susceptible to being ignored.
Absolutely right. Chris, thanks a lot, and thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570. Let me go to Eric in Corvallis. Eric, thanks for listening on Clue. What's on your mind today?
Well, Lars, I was just thinking that the Democrats should invite all these illegal immigrants and bring them over there, and then Trump, he could invite ISIS to be sitting at every door. They can't seem to catch them any other way.
You mean ICE or ISIS? I hope you didn't mean ISIS. You meant ICE.
Yeah.
You know, Eric, I just got word that Congressman Paul Gosar has just contacted the U.S. Capitol Police, as well as the Attorney General, asking if they will consider checking the ID of all those attending the State of the Union and arresting any illegal aliens who attend.
I think that's great. I also think they used to use them stings on criminals, too. You guys have won something, come here, pick it up.
That's right. Wouldn't they usually say, hey, you won Super Bowl tickets or a big screen TV?
Yep.
And then when the criminals would show up, they say, by the way, before we get to your big screen or your free Super Bowl tickets, we've got a warrant here for your arrest. And they would just put them into custody. That's not a half bad idea. And I like the idea from Congressman Gosar. Let's go to Dan in Coos Bay, listening on KWRO. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Good afternoon, Lars. I heard you talk about the free attorneys for shooting victims of police.
Yeah, and I don't call them all. I wouldn't necessarily call them victims. I'd shy away from that word unless you want to do that. But when you have an officer involved, you get it. Okay.
I get it. And I'm gonna preface my statement that I think it's a good idea with. It's a good idea if it gets used the way I am gonna outline it, but it probably won't. And some of the things that go into my thinking are that there, first of all, very few police shootings. I think it's like 700 and something nationwide. It's not a huge financial outlay. And the other thing is that it ends up being this huge, big publicized deal where, they all want answers and they all want to think that their little Johnny didn't do anything wrong. And to the extent that this attorney can help walk these families through the process to the point that they get the closure that they need to understand that it was a legitimate, justified shooting, I think is awesome and would be a good thing for the police or law enforcement public image. And to the extent that there are occasionally, very, very occasionally, unjustified shootings and that this could actually help uncover that, that's a good thing as well. So I don't see a whole lot of downside to it.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you why I'm queasy about this. Most shootings by police agencies and individuals are justified. We know that. At the end of the day, most
Absolutely.
Of them, a very, very small number of what is already a very small number, turn out to be murder. There was a case like that a couple of years ago, I think in North Carolina. It might have been South. In any case, an officer shot a motorist who had done nothing wrong, other than he was running away from the officer, but that didn't justify shooting him. But in the case where you have a wrongful death, a truly wrongful death, the family has no problem getting legal representation for that because there are attorneys who will jump at the chance because if they sue in a truly wrongful death and the family wins $3 million, the attorney gets $1 million of it. He usually typically gets a third. So, you know, I just don't see why the taxpayers should be funding this since what it will probably do is cause the whole process to be dragged out. And imagine this police officer, man or woman, who's had to shoot somebody because of the circumstances. And then the taxpayers are paying for an attorney to try to find every reason not to put that officer back on the job, not to do the right thing with that officer. I just see that as it's a real insult to the people who are in blue and potentially a risk to their career and their freedom. That's why I'm not real crazy about the whole idea. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you on State of the Union Tuesday, and I'm glad to hear your thoughts. In fact, I kind of expect to hear from at least a naysayer or two who doesn't think the president is going to deliver a bang-up speech tonight. But not from this man, not from Hogan Gidley, who is White House Deputy Press Secretary. Hogan, good to have you on the program.
Hey, Lars, thanks so much for the time. I sure appreciate it.
Now, I know you can't give away all the secrets, but give us an idea of what the president has in mind to deliver to America tonight in his State of the Union address.
Absolutely. I think that tonight he's going to focus really on making the main theme of the speech, I should say, is making America safe, strong, and proud. And he's going to talk about really five areas that affect this country. National security, first and foremost, funding the military, making sure they have every tool necessary to defend this nation and also protect our people. Second is the immigration plan that he rolled out the framework for a few days ago. It's a system in immigration that's been broken for the better part of 40 years that's really hurt our country. He's going to talk about infrastructure as well, fixing the crumbling roads and bridges, among other things for our people. Also, trade. I mean, we have a $71 billion trade deficit with Mexico, $17 billion with Canada. And, he ran as a businessman who can fix these things, and he's going to work to make sure that, he puts the interests of Americans first, not alone, but first. And then lastly is the economy and where this country has come from and where it is now with the economy and the rapid job infusion into our nation and record stock market, record GDP. I mean, it's been incredible what he's been able to do in just such a short amount of time with all the naysayers saying it couldn't be done and how it wouldn't affect anybody but the rich. And within a year, he passed a middle-class tax cut and reformed a tax system that hadn't been touched for 30 years. So he's going to talk talk about not just the past and what he's been able to accomplish in the first year, but also in the future, the things we need to take care of to make our nation great again.
Well, and in fact, Hogan, I saw that The Hill, which is one of the two big online presences, covering Capitol Hill, just an hour or so ago, rolled out a story saying that the Democrat Party is in a panic. That's the word, you know, that The Hill uses to describe their state of mind because of the avalanche of good economic news in the country. It's kind of a statement on America that one of our two parties goes into a panic when we get too good an economy going on.
Yeah, I don't know at what point the Democrats decide to be anti-business and anti-American worker. I'm very confused by that. But look, what you're seeing is an exposing of where the Democrat Party is, where its mindset is. And look, you don't have to look too far. A couple of weeks ago, we had a Schumer shutdown. The Democrats decided to keep the government closed. And it was a stark contrast. Because what you had were members of a party who said, blatantly, without any caveat, that we are standing up for and going to the mat for hundreds of thousands of people who are here illegally, unlawfully, as opposed to standing up for hundreds of millions of American citizens. They were willing to put our military payments at risk, payments for border security patrol, payments for first responders fighting wildfires, payments for 8.9 million children who needed the CHIP program from the federal government for health care, all because of a few hundred thousand people who are here illegally. That has continued into this argument over immigration, but it's also continued in their whole mentality. They would much rather play politics with people's lives and actually get something accomplished. And when you hear good economic news, I mean, if these tax cuts had been tied to Hillary Clinton, if this economy had been tied to Hillary Clinton, if the GDP, the influx of manufacturing jobs back in this country had been tied to Hillary Clinton, the most dangerous place in America would have been between a Democrat and a microphone. Because it's Donald Trump, they hate it.
I've got the pleasure of having Hogan Gidley with me now, White House Deputy Press Secretary. You mentioned the illegal aliens, and I think that is the proper term, dreamers who are going to be in the audience, at least a few of them, placed there by members of the Congress who've said, Democrats only, who've said, we're not going to attend the speech. Now, it's only a few of them, but we're going to send illegal alien dreamers in our stead. Does the president plan to reference that, these members of the audience who are not even legally in the country?
Yeah, I'm not going to get ahead of what he's going to say directly.
Oh, sure you can, Hogan. Just tell us.
We'll
keep it between you and me and just the people listening.
Just between you and me. That's right. There you go. Just amongst friends. Here's the deal. I hope they are there because I want them to hear from the man directly who is offering them three times the number of amnesty that Barack Obama offered them. I want them to hear from the man who said, this system is broken, and we welcome you in this country if you do certain things, if you have 10 to 12 years to process, we'll welcome you here. I'm doing it at three times the rate of Barack Obama, and I hope they hear that message because I think what they've been told is that this president is against their presence, is against their ability to get citizenship. This president, in a 55-minute bicameral, bipartisan meeting in the cabinet room, announced he was ready for a pathway to citizenship. Now, the Republicans are not – some Republicans aren't happy because – it shows that the president's willing to work with the other side. But what it also shows is that the president wants to secure the border once and for all. Because we'll deal with you on this DACA piece. We'll give you a little bit more even than you're asking for. But in return, we will build a wall, we will end chain migration, and we will end the visa lottery system, which is where a lot of ways terrorists actually come into this country.
Yep.
But one more thing it does, Lars, I'll wrap up here. One more thing
sure.
It does, it exposes Democrats. You're telling me this president is offering three times what Barack Obama offered, and somehow it's a bad plan? It's everything they've wanted and much, much more, and they still want to hold the government hostage over it.
Now, Hogan, I want to ask you about, it's kind of obscure, but I thought you might have heard some reference to it. There's this memo, this FISA memo, and this committee in Congress had said we can release this thing. And I know that some people think when it comes to the State of the Union, it's all about how many jobs and what's the GDP and all that. But I think it says a lot about our State of the Union. If we have a country where an administration, not this one, but the previous, was able to weaponize one of the most powerful agencies, the FBI, and use it as a political tool. If that happened, if there's evidence it happened, that's a serious statement about our State of the Union. Does the president plan to make any mention of the FISA memo tonight?
He does not plan to make any mention tonight. I can confirm that the memo did come to the White House after the vote yesterday evening. But he will review it with members of his national security team, with members of the White House counsel. Because, look, first and foremost, the president's job is to protect this nation and its citizens. And he would never do anything to jeopardize national security. He's been clear that there are some concerns out there about what was going on at the top levels. It seemed that there was a massive political bias against Donald Trump and a massive political bias for Hillary Clinton during the Hillary Clinton investigation. He supports the rank-and-file members of the FBI. He supports transparency, but he hasn't yet reviewed the memo. And once he does, and once he looks through it, and I just want you to keep this in mind,
all right,
he doesn't have to touch it for 5 days and it still becomes public. His really only action is if he wants to keep it from becoming public. If he sees something that could threaten national security, he can stop it there. But he doesn't have to sign it again. He doesn't have to give the okay. When Congress voted on it, the clock starts, and he's got 5 days. And if he doesn't stop it, it becomes public.
Hogan, you know the issues that this president tackles, and you know that I'm a fan of this president. I've got a dog in the fight. I've got a bias myself, and I admit it to my audience right up front. But can you think of any good reason that Donald Trump would want to hold back any part of those four-page memo from having, you know, going to the American public where we can read it and evaluate it for ourselves? Any reason to hold it back?
Well, I don't know, because I've not read it and I've not seen it. That's a determination for he and his team to make. And I've not talked to him about that particular memo. We're focused, obviously, on the State of the Union here, the first one that the president will have delivered. So that's actually the focus of the White House today, because we know the clock is ticking on the memo. And if he doesn't touch it, it's still coming out. So that's not something we're focused on right now.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, Hogan. Good luck to the president tonight. And by the way, props and kudos to your boss, to Sarah Sanders, because I think she does a fantastic job of not just putting Acosta, but all the other, you know, trolls in the press in their place in a really classy way. And you can send our best regards to her, too.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much. She's a wonderful woman.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Hogan Gidley, who is White House Deputy Press Secretary, will be back in just a moment. Your phone calls and emails are welcome at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. And there's some big breaking news involving Hawaii's false alarm missile guy. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But coming up less than 2 weeks from now, on Friday, February the 9th, we have a special showing, an exclusive showing of the new movie 1517 to Paris, about three American heroes. The movie is the product of Clint Eastwood's directing, and Clint Eastwood decided to tell the story of these three real-life American heroes, and he decided to make the movie with them playing their own roles in this movie called the 1517 to Paris. We are giving away a pair of tickets each and every day, all of this week, all of next week, to come. And we really don't want to give the tickets to you unless you're able to go, because we have so few of them. It's only a 38-seat theater for this special premiere. And that is February the 9th, 6:30 p.m. at the Vancouver Mall Cinetopia. And our thanks to Cinetopia as well. The fifth caller right now at 503-733-4101 wins. That's 503-733-4101. For a pair of tickets, we'll give away another pair tomorrow, I think, in the 2 o'clock hour. So that if you want to get a pair of those tickets, it's going to be an exclusive showing coming up of Clint Eastwood's new movie about the three American heroes. The title of the movie is The 1517 to Paris, which is a reference to that train where a jihadi armed with a gun got on the train and began to shoot people. And these three heroes, unarmed, decided to take him on. Now, there is a fairly significant piece of news. You will recall when the false alarm went out from Hawaii that a missile was inbound. It panicked over 1 million people on that island. And why did it panic them? Because they thought they were about to be killed by a nuclear-tipped missile. It turns out that it was a false alarm. And for a long time, we were told that this was an accident. Well, it turns out that it was part of a drill, that the overnight supervisor decided to stage an unannounced drill, which he's allowed to do. He put on a message that included exercise, 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 meaning that it was a drill. But at the end, He inadvertent now, we've got a winner for the ticket, so the next chance is tomorrow. The at the end of that message, there was a message that said, this is not a drill, which was a mistake. But the man who actually sent out the warning that sent the whole island into a panic until about 40 minutes later when they were able to send out a corrective message, and that was another problem, he is now gone. Take a listen. This is the announcement today.
This was looked at before. The employee has been on for over 10 years. And throughout the 10 years, there have been indications that, well, there have been reports that he has performance issues.
Now, that's what's even worse, that Hawaii would have somebody in their emergency notification center who, over the course of 10 years, has had issues with his job performance. And yet he was in such a critically important role where you could literally tell a million people you're about to die and do it accidentally, that he's had performance issues and they kept him in his job.
And throughout the 10 years, he has confused drills at least two times, a real world drill and a practice drill. It has been noted. They made on-spot corrections. He has been counseled, and it has ended there.
And so to clarify, this employee has been terminated?
Yes, that's correct. This employee has been terminated.
Pardon me?
Yes, that's correct. The employee was terminated.
He has been terminated. By the way, we've got a winner on the ticket, so you'll have to take your next chance tomorrow. But imagine this. They outlined today, weeks later, that the mistake of the false alarm of an inbound missile to Hawaii was made by somebody who has twice before gotten confused about real drills versus the real deal. And that guy has now been fired from his job. Absolutely unbelievable. How many mistakes are you allowed when you're in that kind of job? Well, apparently in Hawaii, the current number is 3 that you're allowed. And let's go to Anna. Sorry, Anna, welcome to the Lawrence Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. So what I wanted to say is, and it's not very popular among my liberal friends, but I think that all of these people that want to help the Dreamers and these illegal immigrants, especially ones from Mexico, is in these sanctuary cities, they need to make volunteer organizations that help them go back to Mexico and improve Mexico. Because America didn't start out the way that it is now. You know, we changed that slowly.
Very few countries do.
Right, they don't. And so these people want to keep coming here and coming here where it's already good. But, you know, then they're sending, I mean, all the people that come here usually send money back to families in Mexico. So they're sending all the money they make here back to Mexico.
Because they view that as their real country.
Right. So what they need to do is stay in Mexico. And I'm not saying, like, go back to your country. I'm saying stay there. Make it better. Do protests, you know, demand better wages. You know, do it the way that we did it here over a long time. And then, you know, maybe in 100 years, maybe in less, maybe in 50, it'll be like it is here. And that, you know, that would be the best for everyone.
I think you're absolutely right. And frankly, by allowing people to come in illegally, work illegally, send money back, we're actually holding back reforms that would be demanded much more quickly if you said, no,
right?
You have to stay on your side of the wall or come in legally. That if you did that, an awful lot of people would demand that reforms happen. Instead, we're kind of like the pressure relief valve for Mexico. And who does that benefit? Do you think that benefits the least people in Mexico? No, it benefits the elites. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is State of the Union Tuesday on the program, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network as well. Glad to get your calls a bit later at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. One of the subjects that comes up time and again on this program is a subject that involves the way that we handle criminals. And there seems to be a push. In fact, I started today's broadcast with a commentary on the fact that liberal elected officials seem to constantly be demanding that we downsize the punishment for criminals. And when it comes to juvenile criminals, they put that on steroids. They say, we have to treat these kids differently, even if they've committed some of the worst crimes out there. So I want, when I saw this study that had come out called Youth and Measure 11, the Oregon Council on Civil Rights, harsh sentences have not kept pace with modern brain science. I knew the guy I had to talk to was Clackamas County's District Attorney John Foote, and he joins me now. John, thanks for taking the time today.
Good afternoon, Lars.
So this report, Youth and Measure 11, Impacts of Mandatory Minimums, you've read it. You're familiar with it, right?
I've looked it over, yeah.
Yeah, and it draws the conclusion that sometimes because young people don't have fully developed brains, some of the science I've seen says their brains don't fully develop till they're in their mid-20s, that when they commit crimes as juveniles, that we should treat them much more lightly than Measure 11, which is a two-times voter-passed law that actually, I saw it drop crime in Oregon after tougher sentences were adopted. This seems to be part of this effort to downsize the punishment that we do for things that, in your business, you call person crimes, where it's not a car that gets stolen or a house that gets burglarized. It's a person who gets hurt or raped or killed, right?
Yes. Yeah, criminal justice in Oregon is under assault by a wide variety of nonprofits who are funded with out-of-state money from people like George Soros. And the money's all hidden, but they have a ton of money. And they're just leaking into everything. This report, Lars, was written under the auspices of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And yet it's a report on criminal sentencing.
That's Brad Avakian's Bureau of Labor.
It has nothing to do with labor and industry. Nothing.
And
it's just an opportunity to publish propaganda.
Well, for example, and part of this propaganda has to do with, it essentially says kids of color get treated far worse. In fact, it actually says they're harmed by the criminal justice system. That's certainly not the aim of the criminal justice system. Isn't the aim to get them not to commit the crime again?
Well, yes. Our aim is, first of all, to provide justice to the victims of crime and to our community by providing a proportional punishment for the crime. That is fundamentally what people want. So the most serious crimes, rapes and murders, require much more serious punishment. And that is, in fact, I believe, our first job in our work. And, you know, everybody has a sense of what is kind of a proportional punishment. These folks have no concern about that issue at all. They have no concern about victims. They will tell you they do, but everything they write is about the offenders. For instance, we publish the DAs, and I do this for them, about every year. We publish a list of all the juveniles in custody on Measure 11 in Oregon. And we're doing one now. It's not done yet, but we did one last year. And there were 80 youth in Oregon in prison for homicides.
Out of a state 80. Population of more than 4 million, you have 80 youth who are in up.
I mean,
that's
a lot of homicides. And that's the kind of people that are in. Over almost half the juveniles in for Measure 11 are in for sex crimes against children. They're either underage, well under 12, or they're being forced. These are forcible rapes. So these are really serious crimes. The vast majority of juveniles are never in Measure 11. And so this whole thing about brain science, yes, of course, we know kids are different, and we treat them differently in the juvenile system for the vast majority of them. But there are certain crimes, and this is why Measure 11 was created. There are certain crimes, and in the eyes of the people who wrote this report, these people, even the people who commit these crimes, wouldn't be in custody. And in fact, before we had Measure 11, they usually weren't.
Well, and in fact, and you point out that the man who created this, the labor commissioner, Brad Avakian, his quote right in the middle of the press release that's being pushed out on this study is that youths charged under Measure 11 face lifetime barriers to education and employment. Oregon's juvenile justice system brings high cost and poor outcomes. We should modernize our approach. So he's extending sympathy to these juvenile sexual criminals, juvenile violent criminals who've committed violent assaults, juvenile murderers. And he's saying, gosh, after you've murdered somebody and got convicted, or after you've raped somebody and got convicted, it's tough to find a job and to go to college. Well, boo-hoo, I would think would be the response from most people, even in a liberal state. So you have a tough time finding a job? Yeah, most murderers and rapists probably would.
Yeah, you know, I don't even know what to say to things like that. The truth is always a lot more complicated than these sort of platitudes that people put out. About 3 years ago, I asked somebody I highly respect, a friend of mine, a colleague, to take a look at the part of the juvenile system outside Measure 11. And we published a report. And it's, if anybody wants to see it, it's on our website under the tab News. Juvenile Justice in Oregon, I think is the title of it. It's about 70 or 80 pages.
All right.
It's filled with data. It does not paint a good picture of the juvenile justice system outside of Measure 11. There's a lot of struggles with what to do with juvenile offenders in addition to the ones who are in on Measure 11. There's no some shining example. And the truth is, as since Measure 11 was put in place, violent crime in Oregon dropped 50%, including juvenile violent crime.
And by the way, John, I'm talking to John Foote, who's the DA in Clackamas County. Was there anything else going on at the time that would have explained that 50% drop in violent crime?
Well, you know, everybody's got their theory. Nobody knows. What I can tell you is that there's a graph that shows when Measure 11 passed, violent crime started to drop like a rock in Oregon. It had dropped nationally before then, but a lot of states had toughened their laws before we did. You know, the thing is that Measure 11 is the big bugaboo for these folks. But the truth is, it's a tiny fraction of the offenders that we deal with, either as adults or juveniles. The vast majority of them don't go to prison. We do these alternative programs. And these Measure 11 is reserved for the most serious crimes, in which our first concern is justice, proportional punishment. And I encourage anyone to go and look at the list of juvenile offenders that we put together. The spreadsheet we have is got all of them with their names and the facts of the crime and their criminal history and what the sentence they got.
Well,
we're not hiding the ball here.
I want you to share one other thing with my audience, and I want to get your point of view on this. Before Measure 11, it was probably true that if you were a young, white, well-represented offender, criminal, that you were likely to have a pretty good outcome, that you were going to be, you're going to probably get probation even for crimes like rape. That after Measure 11, that for all the people who want to play the race card, like Avakian seems to want to play the race card here and say, oh gosh, this is terrible for kids of color, that what Measure 11 did was it leveled the playing field on race, so that the well-represented, affluent neighborhood white kid whose mommy and daddy could buy a really good lawyer to come down and defend them ended up with the same result as the black kid from the poor neighborhood whose mom and dad had to take the public defender for the defense on their kid, that it tended to level those things out, where before Measure 11, you would get a very different result often for white kids and black kids. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I'd put it a different way, and I'd use data.
All right.
Is what I like to use. Race is a really important. I mean, racism is unjust. It's a pure form of injustice. So we all stand, anyone who stands for justice stands against racism. Racial disparity is a very difficult subject to talk about. But I want everyone sort of take sides based on their ideology, and it's very hard to have fact-based conversation. But I'll give you this. A year ago, I decided that I was curious about what had happened to racial disparity in our prison system since Measure 11 took effect in 1995. So I looked at racial disparity before it took effect and racial disparity now. And what I found is contrary to what the folks who are pitching all this stuff say. Since Measure 11 passed in the last 23 years, racial disparity in our prison system has actually, it has gotten much less. And the racial disparity for African Americans has been cut in half. It's still disparate, but it's been cut in half. The racial disparity for Hispanics has basically disappeared. their population in the prison system is fairly equal to their population in the general population in Oregon. So what's happened is that Measure 11 has improved racial disparity. But will you ever hear these advocates look at that kind of data and say, huh, maybe that's not so bad? So that's what's happened. That's the data. I've got the chart. It's based on the data from the Census Bureau and from our prison system. And it's good news.
I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this. Hey, John, thanks very much for your time and what you do as DA of Clackamas County.
Thanks, Lord. Take care.
Glad to have you on. John Foote with us. Back in a moment. I'll be glad to take your calls. You know naysayers go to the head of the line on this program. And tomorrow we'll have more tickets to give away to the brand new Clint Eastwood movie, The 1517 to Paris. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to State of the Union Tuesday. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, should schools with the name of slave owners get new names? We're talking in this case about Jefferson High School. Although, if you want to start pulling the name Jefferson and Washington and a few others off, you're going to be denaming a whole bunch of places here in the Pacific Northwest. Should health care be added to the state constitution as a constitutional right? No, that's crazy. But then it's being proposed by a bunch of Democrats today. And in King County, the Metropolitan King County Council has unanimously adopted the law, legislation, to provide publicly funded legal representation during inquests to the families of those killed as a result of police use of deadly force. Pretty dumb idea, if you ask me. Now, the Constitution says if you're accused of a crime, you have a right to counsel. It doesn't actually say a lawyer, but we've translated that as counsel means a lawyer today and these days. But where in the world do you get the right to have a publicly funded lawyer when a member of your family has done something that caused the police to shoot that person, in most cases, justifiably? And yet the public is going to fund a lawyer for your family. So that what? You can look for new opportunities to file that lawsuit and win a couple of $1 million? Does that make any sense? And do you think that the labor commissioner in Oregon, Brad Avakian, who is now pushing the idea that we are treating young criminals too harshly under Measure 11, have you heard that number? 80 kids right now, 80 juveniles are currently up for Measure 11 treatment. That's it, 80. Out of a state of 4 million people, and a smaller number of juveniles, closer to about 750,000 juveniles. That's about the number. And out of that, 80 of them are accused of Measure 11 crimes. And you think we're treating them too harshly? Because Brad Avakian says, you know, after a young man goes out and commits a rape or maybe a murder, it's tough for him to find a job or go to college or get some housing. Yeah, I kind of think it is. And I kind of think there's nothing wrong with that, too. Let's go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Lars. You had a caller earlier that was expressing his disconcern he seemed concerned, now I think about it, about Maria Cantwell bringing an illegal immigrant to the State of the Union tonight. I actually called their office and confirmed, yes, indeed, she is. So I think that's marvelous because it just came over the wire. The Capitol Police will be arresting them tonight.
No. You didn't take that seriously, did you? No, I don't think so.
Well, I've seen it on two different sources.
Hold on a second. When you seen it, did you see it on the Internet? Because I got to tell you something. The Internet, while it's a great research tool, is also kind of a giant pile of garbage most of the time. And you have to know how to sort out the good stuff from the bad stuff. It's like saying I went to a bookstore and I read it in a book. Well, in any given bookstore, you might find 1,000 books, and there might be 30 or 40 really good ones out of 1,000, and the rest of it is garbage. So please don't believe everything you read on the Internet. The Capitol Police have no plans tonight to start arresting illegal aliens. And in fact, I think if they did, and it was done at the order of the president or Paul Ryan or, you know, or that idiot, you know, from Kentucky over in the Senate, it would probably be a political and an optics disaster if they did. So please don't believe that.
Seems to me that it's a bad optic, them not doing it.
Well, I mean, there are pluses and minuses to both. It certainly makes a statement about our country that when you're here in our country illegally, that somehow you end up with a special seat to sit in the Capitol building and listening to the president's State of the Union address. On the other hand, I think it also affords Donald Trump a great opportunity to say something directly to those illegal aliens in the chamber and to everybody else in America who either likes them or wishes that they would, you know, follow the law like the rest of us have to. I think that's a statement as well. But if you saw them, I can tell you this from having been in the news business for a long time. If they dragged 10 illegal aliens out of the Capitol in handcuffs and that video would play endlessly and nobody would hear anything else Donald Trump says tonight during the State of the Union, all they would focus on is the visual of some 19 or 20 year old wearing a suit and a tie and everything else being handcuffed and then being forcibly removed from the Capitol. I can tell you that that's not the kind of message that you want to send.
Well, yeah, that's propaganda, and that has no place in our country.
Well, except that you remember, you're living in a country where 90% of the media that you have access to on the internet, on cable television, on satellite, and every other source, 90% of it is generated by people who are very good at putting propaganda out there. So they won't hesitate one second to do exactly what I just said. Take that video and run it over and over and over again. And they will split screen it with the president on one side talking about DACA dreamers and the Capitol Police dragging people out of the Capitol. So I don't think you should believe everything that you read on the internet. Just my suggestion. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Calling all cars. Everybody wants less parking spaces and less cars on the roads and less pollution.
I hate traffic.
Blah, blah, blah. As you can imagine, Lars has an opinion on this. You're in for the ride of your life.
There's a long line of cars and they're trying to get...
This is the War on the Car.
You might want to buckle up.
On the Lars Larson Show.
Ah, that's right. We got to talk about it with Aaron Brown, who is spokesperson for No More Freeway Expansions PDX. Aaron, thank you for joining me today.
Good afternoon, Lars. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Now, you should know, I think you do already, that I'm a fan of the automobile, that I believe that... Go ahead.
I am, too. I'm actually calling you from a parked automobile.
Well, there you go. So you're already part of the way there. Now, why shouldn't we build more freeways and roads and streets and bridges and everything else that it takes for people who commute in automobiles, who are still the majority of commuters, to be able to get around?
Because it won't work. I'll say this. I'm here specifically to talk about freeways, and in particular, the $450 million freeway expansion for 1.8 miles of freeway in inner northeast Portland. Lars, I frequently drive through this corridor. I grew up in Beaverton. I'm frequently driving around the region. There isn't a single city in North America that has made traffic better for its citizens by expanding the freeways. There's this concept called induced demand, which has been proven in cities over decades. Economists, traffic engineers, urban planners have all proven it to be true, that if you make the freeways wider, it only encourages more people to drive, which in turn just adds to our traffic congestion. So even if you love cars, as you do, and as I do as well, you'll ultimately be stuck in traffic more unless we find other ways to get people off the roads.
You know, Aaron, here's the problem with what you say. If we took that same approach to water supply, which is typically done the same way roads are done in big America, in all American cities. And we said, gosh, if we built bigger water pipes, why, people would go out and build more houses and they'd move more families in. If we build bigger sewer pipes, they just install more toilets. Well, the problem is the job of government is to serve its citizens, not to punish them for their choices. So if you tell me we shouldn't build more freeways because people will just use them, isn't that what we're building the freeways for people to use them?
Absolutely, Lars. And as a taxpayer, I want to pay taxes to ensure that I'm able to drive on a road free of congestion. When I need to drive because I'm picking up kids or I've got a big load of stuff and I need to get across town quickly and I need to rely on a car, I have to be able to assume that there won't be some big wreck on the road or whatever it is. This is, in fact, me saying if we want to ensure that fundamental right as people that live in the Portland region of mobility, of being able to get around, there isn't a single example, Lars, in which building the freeways wider has made traffic better. This isn't a piece of moral perspective. This is like fundamentally, as regions grow, you look at all the cranes in downtown Portland and across the region, more and more people are moving here. We all see it. There's
fundamentally, geometrically, not enough room on our roads for every single one of us to use an automobile for every single
trip. So what you would propose then is rather than spending $450 million to improve one of the biggest choke points on Interstate 5 between Canada and Mexico, you would say, I assume, that you would choose congestion pricing, where we literally punish people for using the roads they've already paid for, that are put there for their use, and we tell them, if you're rich, you'll be able to drive on the roads. If you're not so rich, you won't be able to afford to use the roads that you've already paid for. Am I right that that's your proposed solution?
I would frame it differently, Lars.
Of course you would.
Lars, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a taxpayer. This freeway expansion that we're talking about at $450 million, by the way, that's twice the price of the affordable housing bond, seven times the gas tax, and $120 million more than Measure 101 just passed for healthcare, right? There isn't a single economist or transportation planner that says this will make traffic better.
Okay, but hold on. You keep going back to that point. Let me point out a different comparison. At $450 million for almost 2 miles, it's no more expensive than the last light rail project. It's less expensive than the next light rail project planned for Portland. It's a half of the cost per mile of the next light rail project proposed for Seattle. So when you want to compare it to other things like that, let's compare it and say, if $250 million a mile is too expensive, then all of the light rail that's being planned right now for Portland, Seattle, and Spokane is too expensive by that measure. And the light rail carries a considerably smaller number of people than automobiles do.
Lars, you cut me off, so I didn't get a chance to finish my point.
All right.
The $450 million freeway expansion will not make traffic better. Fundamentally, there isn't a single, even ODOT, the Oregon Department of Transportation, and the Portland Bureau of Transportation, their planners in support of this project have testified at City Council acknowledging that the impacts, if there are any, will be substantially minimal, right? So when you're stuck in traffic and you've spent $100 on increase on your car tabs and everything else, that the gas tax and the stuff that was passed in the transportation bill in Salem last year, know that your money essentially just got spent on nothing, right? Now, meanwhile, you're right that light rail is expensive, and we certainly need to be finding ways.
It's far more expensive per commuter.
Lars, please stop interrupting me. I'm trying to make my point here.
Cost-effective
investments in things like congestion pricing. If you were to spend $5 million to institute congestion pricing on I-5, that would cost a 50th of building this.
Hold on, Aaron, stop for a second. Don't filibuster. If you invested in congestion pricing, you realize what you're proposing. People who have a good-sized paycheck, like me, will have no problem paying it. But the average worker who's told that you're going to increase the cost of them driving to work by $10 or $20 a day is going to be priced out. So you're going to be jamming them into some other mode of getting to work. You're going to say to them, if you want to drive to work, because on the way home from work, you need to pick up groceries and your kids and your dry cleaning and your wife or your husband, it's going to cost you $20 a day or $30. I mean, there's almost no ceiling to this. You're going to be punishing the least economically capable people in the region, and you're going to be rewarding the doctors and lawyers and talk show hosts who can afford to get in their car and pay the extra $20, and I'll have an empty freeway. So if I have a bias at all, it should be in favor of this. But I hate this idea because what it does to every other citizen in the region, it punishes them and says, you can't afford to drive on the road that you've already paid for. Now, tell me how that's morally justified.
I will right now.
All right.
First of all, I will say that the organizations and advocates that consistently and reliably advocate for economic justice, environmental justice, social justice, the lefties, your favorite folks,
yeah, Lars,
they're all in support of this. They are sitting on the committee at ODOT, and they are actively interested in this. Why? Because they know that projects like a $450 million freeway expansion, if that was instead spent, Lars, that amount of money would buy free bus passes for everyone in TriMet for the next 4 years. I mean, okay, this is a massive amount of money we're talking about,
Aaron,
for a project that will not make congestion better. So second, here's why it's just, Lars. It's the notion that, you know, it is more important to promise mobility than it is to promise that you can get there with an automobile. And I agree, cars are convenient and they're awesome and they're great for when you need to get across town with a bunch of stuff. But why is it that, and your notion that it's going to cost $10, $20, $30, that's
almost certainly not true. Like, you're probably going to see, if it was instituted appropriately, it'll be $2 to $3.
Aaron,
and that is cheaper than the cost of a full day light rail pass.
I'm going to tell you, but I'll tell you why.
More money to take a light rail.
Hold on, but Aaron, I'm going to tell you why
on a massive freeway.
It will have to be that much, and here's why. We'll go right back to what you stated as your goal. Your goal is to make the freeways flow. So if to make the freeways flow, you have to remove, say, 10% of the commuters. I'll bet on most days, if you took 10, maybe 15% of the commuters off the roads, the freeways would flow like crazy. The problem is to raise the price high enough that somebody can actually afford, or somebody will be pressured into getting off the road, it's not going to be $2 each direction. Unless you really think that this is so price sensitive that if you tell somebody who ordinarily views a car as a necessity because of the other things they have to do on their commute to work and home, that if you raise the price by $2, they'll say, oh, gosh, I can't take my car now. I'll take the bus instead, and I'll take two or three times as much time sitting on transit that I would in my automobile because of $2. I don't think you've taken an econ course. The number is not that low. Even when gas prices went to $1.50 higher than they are currently, you only saw about a 3% reduction in miles traveled. Why? Because people knocked off the optional trips. They might say, well, I'm not driving down to the beach, or I'm not driving to the mountains tonight or this weekend. But they still did all the trips they viewed as necessary. Work, the kids, the grocery store, the dry cleaning, whatever, picking up things, going to friends' houses. So you really think $2 additional is going to take what? 8 or 10 or 15% of the people off the roads? Really?
Lars, I respect where you're coming from, and I just want to say that you've got these perspectives and opinions. There are people with PhDs that have been studying traffic demand and studying traffic engineering for decades.
The same PhDs who said that Hillary Clinton was going to win the presidency? That number bunch?
Yeah. They were different PhDs. I agree. Some people really.
But they were all using numbers. Their numbers said that it was absolutely impossible that Donald Trump would be president. And guess where they ended up with all those numbers?
Numbers don't always work out. But let me tell you this, Lars. It doesn't take a lot of folks getting off the roads to make traffic flow freely, at least much more freely than it does.
All right, tell me what's the number. What's the percentage?
Let me finish this.
All right.
You were specifically saying the notion of, is this going to improve the flow of our freeways? And the answer is, it doesn't take much, right? Fundamentally, getting a couple cars off of the road will open up the freeways in these other contexts, and we're encouraging people with a slight push. You know, we can also have all sorts of things in there so that working class folks or folks under a certain amount or that are close to the poverty line could get a pass on having to pay the fee or whatever it is. We could be putting that money into transit so that folks that live in neighborhoods where transit is a viability, maybe not for folks in the outer suburbs where it's harder to get by, but by making the buses run more frequent, it becomes more competitive as an option. And our goal ultimately, Lars, is to make sure that everyone's able to get where they need to go. And at our current moment, anyone that's been driving on our freeways knows that our freeways are crowded and more people are moving here. And anyone that has looked at any freeway expansion anywhere in North America will see that this project won't solve it. And Lars, I'm surprised you're not more skeptical of a massive $500 million government investment in infrastructure that has no demonstrable impact on making people's lives better.
Like, no, actually it does. I've looked at it, and I understand the argument you're making, that you're saying it's not necessarily going to make traffic flow quicker because all of the infrastructure around it is not going to change. But if you're going to tell me that it's okay to spend billions of dollars, and the last light rail actually completed in this region was $223 million a mile. So when you tell me it's okay to spend $223 million a mile on light rail that carries a few thousand people, but it's not okay to spend $250 million a mile to improve a freeway system that is the main linkage all the way from Canada to Mexico on Interstate 5, your logic doesn't add up to me.
Well, Lars, I'm not here to shill for light rail. I'm here to say that, like, this freeway investment is a boondoggle. For $5 to $10 million little patch fixes here and there, we could make our bus system run incredibly well. I agree.
Hold on, Aaron. You really want to go into the bus system? Hold through the break, and I'll talk to you on the other side of the break. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. And Aaron Brown is with me. His group is fighting against the idea of using $450 million to make a major improvement on a couple of miles of I-5 at a critical infrastructure join. Aaron, let me put this to you. you say, well, we need to have people on the bus, and we'll take a couple of, you know, some of the money from this bunch that we wouldn't spend on the freeway, and we'll make the bus system run better. You're aware that TriMet, the Metropolitan Transit Agency for Portland, is functionally bankrupt. They have a $1 billion unfunded liability for pension and medical, and at least a few people like John Charles at Cascade Policy have figured out that if they keep on this path and they don't find some magic Dutch uncle to fund them down the line, they're going to, by 2024, they may literally have only enough money to fund their pension and medical obligations and no money to run buses and trains. So we're supposed to switch people, I guess tens of thousands of people, over to riding the bus or the train when the bus and train agency is functionally bankrupt?
Lars, I came on your program today to talk about a freeway expansion. I have no doubt that there's lots of governing issues with TriMet that need to be addressed, and I'm not here to stand up for any particular aspect of any massive infrastructure investment in light rail, although I do believe that light rail is the way to go forward. I'm here today to specifically say that your buddy John Charles is actually in opposition to this freeway. He absolutely put out a statement earlier that said congestion pricing seems like a much more thoughtful way to go about it. It's a market approach.
Well, he's a libertarian,
What I'm saying is that this isn't just a bunch of granola-eating hippies in Northeast Portland with a bunch of flannel and bike riders, although they are absolutely concerned about this as well.
Well, for example,
that are living in the neighborhood that are worried about the impacts on air quality. They are folks that are concerned about climate change. Lars, if I had a child today, there's a decent chance that he or she would be alive in 2100. From an impact of carbon emissions, 40% of Portland's carbon emissions come from...
Now you just said you don't want to change the subject, and you're going off into global warming. Carl writes in, and he says, Lars, I have used the bus system here in the Seattle area, and it's a good comparison to some I've used in other states, but I wouldn't be spending 2 hours each way to work a $13-an-hour job. When you force a lot of people off the roads and take them away from reliable transportation that gets them to their work on time when their boss needs them there, you're going to change a lot of other things, and you may not be changing things for the better. You've got to have a working economy and prosperity to be able to get clean air, too, don't you?
Lars, I absolutely agree. But anyone that lives, that got priced out of inner Portland and they live out in the suburbs somewhere, they live in Vancouver and they need an opportunity to get to their job in downtown Portland, the freeways aren't reliable right now, right? That's what I'm fundamentally getting at. I agree that the direction that some of our leaders in transit haven't been making the right decisions, but that is what we are fundamentally asking for, is a realignment of how do we move the most people around the region most effectively. And there isn't a single city in North America that has said that the way to do this or has been able to accomplish that by spending billions and billions of dollars on freeway.
Aaron, I'm up against the break, but I appreciate you coming on. You're a good naysayer, even though I think you're wrong, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's State of the Union Tuesday. Tonight, the president gives his first official State of the Union address, and a lot of people are anticipating what he's going to say. We've already been told he will not talk about the FISA memo, although I'm sure that what he probably plans to do is take no action at all and just let it become public 5 days after the committee voted yesterday to let that happen. Glad to have you with me live on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to get your phone calls and emails. If you've got a moment, vote in our Twitter poll. Today's question, should schools with the names of slave owners get new names? The question involves, in this particular case, Jefferson High School. But I think it's a ridiculous argument. Are you going to go out and take down every Jefferson, every Washington, every person who had slaves, who was part of America's founding and part of America's growth, and you're going to simply tear their names off every public building in America? You're going to take the name of the state of Washington off? What are you going to change it to? Pelosi or Feinstein? I guess you could do that, too. Anyway, welcome to the program. We're going to give away another pair of tickets tomorrow for the movie premiere of Clint Eastwood's new flick, which is The 1517 to Paris, about three American heroes, and a movie in which a brilliant director like Eastwood is using the real-life heroes to play their own roles. But again, an additional pair of tickets tomorrow, and then one on Thursday, Friday, and then all of next week. And then we have the special showing on February 9th at Cinetopia in Vancouver. I want to get to your phone calls and emails now at 866-HEY-LARS. First to Sharon. Hey, Sharon, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. I started out with only having one thing on my mind, but your last caller just kind of picked me a little bit.
Okay.
I'm 71, and I'm still working because I couldn't afford to live in the Portland area, so I bought a home in Sweet Home. 4 days a week, I commute to Beaverton, which is a 200-mile round trip.
Ouch.
And anything that makes it more expensive to make that commute hurts me.
Yep.
And then my other point is that with the talk of the illegals and stuff, I very rarely hear the point I'm going to make. I got into a discussion with someone on Facebook the other day, and they basically called me stupid because I said you had to be here legally or a U.S. citizen to get a Social Security card.
A green card has a social and so does a citizen. You're right.
I looked it up. And according to Social Security, the only way you can get a legal Social Security card is if you have a active valid visa, if you have a green card, if you are a legal resident, or you are a U.S. citizen.
That's true.
Now, my point here is everybody talks about the illegals. Well, all they're doing is coming here illegally. They're not committing any crimes. But in order to work in this country, you have to have a Social Security card. Illegals can't get a Social Security card. So if they're working legally, so to speak, they're using someone else's Social Security card. And in my book, that's identity theft.
Well, I'll tell you something,
and
Sharon.
That's a crime.
I can tell you specifically, any use of a Social Security number in America other than the legal use that is specified is a crime. You're absolutely right. It's actually a federal crime if you use a social. So if I use your social or you use mine or you made up a Social Security number that wasn't real, all of those things are crimes. And we do talk about that on the show. But all of those people who are working illegally are committing half a dozen different crimes. Crossing in was a crime. Identifying yourself not truthfully is a crime. Signing that I-9 form that when you take a job, you have to sign the I-9 form. And that's called false swearing. That's a crime. If you use somebody else's social, that's a crime. So you've got lots of crimes that are adding up together in those kinds of things. Let's go to Kent, who's calling in. Hey, Kent, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. I take it you heard our conversation with the gentleman who doesn't want us to see us spend $450 million to make some critical improvements to a part of Interstate 5.
Yeah, that Aaron guy, I mean, him and his PhD buddies and their leftist utopian world they live in is just kind of a crazy little place. But I tell you, I'm a professional driver myself, and I drive downtown and on the freeways every day for 10, 12 hours a day. And I can tell you that their PhDs will get them absolutely nowhere. They need a good sense of dose of common sense. But I do have a solution if you want to hear it, Lars.
I'd love to hear it.
Okay, the way I see it, I look down the road as I'm driving during rush hour, which quite frankly is only about 30% of the day that the roads are really congested. So 60% of the day, the roads are just fine. But during rush hour, I look around and there are 90% of the vehicles with single occupancy drivers in it.
That's true.
So we have a wasted resource in the empty seats in those vehicles that are going down the road. So what can we do to solve the problem? Well, the way I see it, you can incentivize people. Instead of punishing people with tolls and fees and this and that and the heavy hand of government, why don't we utilize a technology such as Uber Pool or Lyft or somebody that's here already and get it on everybody's cell phone where they could commute as a carpool with neighbors in their neighborhood? Maybe there's a big lot at the grocery store at the end of the I-5 bridge in Vancouver. And we fill up these seats that are going down the road. If somebody can make $400, $500, $600 extra dollars a month putting somebody in their car with them and dropping them close to their home, I think that would solve the problem. What do you think?
Well, it's an interesting idea. And actually, the guy I mentioned earlier, John Charles from Cascade Policy Institute, proposed this way back before the internet, back in the 1980s. He was proposing that they somehow hook people up with pagers. Actually, it's that old an idea that it was an idea originally proposed using pagers. So you'd put in a request electronically and say, I'd like to go from A to B. And they would try to match you up with somebody else who is already going from A to B. Here's part of the problem with it, Kent. First of all, if you tell me, Lars, we're going to have you ride in somebody else's car, but it'll be convenient. He'll swing by your house and pick you up, and we're going to charge you something for that ride. Let's say you charge me a cost as low as $5 to get to work. I'm 13 miles to work, so $5 would be a pretty small charge. I might have to say to myself, well, hold on, I'm only going 13 miles in my car. That's about $2 worth of gasoline. So am I going to pay $5 to go in a way that I could go for $2 worth of gasoline because I still own my car? And even if I ride to work with somebody else, I'm not going to give up my automobile for the other things I need it for. So I've still got those other costs, the main cost being buying the automobile, insuring the automobile, maintaining it, paying for all the maintenance, and putting fuel in the tank. But if the choice between riding with somebody else for $5 or driving my own car for $2, I've already got a situation where riding in my own car is already superior to your idea. Then you say, oh, and by the way, the guy's got a couple of other people in his car, too. So on your drive home, he's going to have to pull off somewhere nearby, and it may only take another 10 or 15 minutes to drop off these other guys. And I say, well, I don't want to do that. Oh, and by the way, I want to stop a couple of places on the way home. I want to stop and I want to get gasoline. I want to stop and I want to, you know, buy something at the grocery store, pick up my dry cleaning or whatever. And when I get all those things on, I say, can we do those things if I ride in your car? And they're going to say, no, we can't do those things if you ride in my car because we're taking care of other people. So you see how it becomes more complicated. If I say, well, on the way home, you know, if you're a person who's of childbearing age and you say, well, I've got two kids I got to pick up at the daycare. Well, we can't stop for that. You're going to have to go back later on your own after we've taken you home. Do you see how it quickly becomes a little bit thorny? It's not very attractive financially. It's not very attractive time-wise. And it's not very attractive when it comes to the practicalities of daily life, which isn't just getting...
Very true, but the point I wanted to make is that it wouldn't come out of the commuters. Instead of spending that $450 million of taxpayer money on a brand new whatever road that's really going to go to nowhere and solve no problems, why don't we take that money... And actually, the riders don't pay a dime.
It's subsidized.
It's almost like a free government program. If they want to spend all the money on building stuff to accommodate more cars, more pollution, more traffic jams,
let me tell you why the numbers don't add up. Let's say you had that whole 450 and you didn't have to do any improvements on the freeway. So you're going to spend, say, out over the next 3 years, which is 1,000 days. Right? $450 million divided by 1,000, that's $450,000 a day, which sounds like a lot of money. But how many rides does it buy you? It buys you $450,000 divided by $5, if you figure the cost of the ride is $5. And you see how many rides you get? It's not nearly enough to make a gigantic difference. And that's assuming you took that one capital piece of expenditure and you spent it on operations costs, which is the daily rides. And you know the difference there. It's one thing to buy infrastructure. It's another thing to pay capital costs. So after the 3 years and you've exhausted all the money buying, you know, some rides for people, where are you going to fund the rest of this? And who do you fund it on the back?
Like your favorite thing, you could cut ODOT in half.
Well, I would love to cut ODOT in half. In fact, I'd love to get rid of the prevailing wage. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. About this conversation we're having about transportation and all, Lars, says George, use their own language. Light rail is 19th century tech. Buses are last century tech. Future is electric self-driving cars. What are they going to move on? Light rails? No, they need roadways. So invest in this century's coming solution. And George, that's a very good way to put it. To your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I want to put Chad on from LeGrand, listening on KLBM. Chad, you heard our conversation about prison sentences and how the labor commissioner of Oregon, Brad Avakian, is trying to push people to say, we got to get rid of these tough sentences for violent crimes. You had an idea on that. What is it?
Well, I was a correctional officer at two facilities in Oregon. And when I present this idea to you, Lars, I want you to know that it was something I came up with on my own just by observing. Whether I'm right or wrong or this would work, this is just something that I just realized one day it came to me after working in the prison system with hands-on experience. My idea, whether it would be rape, arson, murder, whatever the crime is, My observation was, well, first of all, you have to look at the offender. Most offenders, I'm not a psychologist, don't claim to be, this is just my observation. Most offenders are what I would describe as takers. They've taken from society.
Right.
They don't think like most of us, normal, hardworking, honest, tax-paying people. They're takers. They've already taken. My observation was, and then I'll present my idea.
Okay, because we got to get to it because we're spending a lot of time kind of leading up to it. What's the idea?
Okay. The thing is, a couple of examples, like at the prison in Umatilla, Two Rivers. Inmates are allowed three times a day to go over to a fountain station and drink Coca-Cola, orange pop, Barks root beer. That's just an example. They're also allowed to do things like check out sewing needles from the officer's stations. If they have a heart condition and need a $100,000 operation, they're allowed to have that operation. So my idea, all these, they already have the mindset of being a taker. We send them to prison and we give them more and more. They get their sense of entitlement, their narcissism increases by the way we continue to give them all these things. Now, I'm not saying that we throw them in a room, lock them away with no lights, one meal a day. I'm not saying we torture them. But my idea is this. We shortened the sentences for these crimes. You know, we can't do it. Some of them, they have to go away for life. That's the way it is. But we shorten these sentences for some of these crimes, but we make the time they do a lot less, I don't know what the word would be.
Difficult?
Yeah. We take...
Well, we make it harder. So
We make it where it leaves an impact, a better chance of an impact in their brain and their mindset and their thinking process, that it might actually change their thinking, which is the goal of the Department of Corrections anyway.
Okay, but you're going to do this by, if I understand your idea right, because I like the observation that these are takers. So do you make them have to start giving up things? So if you say, hey, here's your cell, and they say, well, where's my blanket? Well, you get a blanket if you work for it. Oh, and by the way, we'll give you enough food to keep you alive. It'll be Nutriloaf. If you worked in corrections, you know what that is. You want the nicer food and the condiments and the ketchup and the salt and pepper? Well, that comes from working or doing some things, you know, for the system.
Here's one of the biggest issues. One of the biggest issues is the misunderstanding. The general public does not have a clue what it's like inside a state.
Okay, I get all that, but tell us what, that's not telling anybody, saying people don't know anything. Now tell us what you've observed that will help fix this problem.
Okay, for example, there should not be a Coca-Cola fountain unit on a prison unit in any state prison.
I agree.
So I would take away soda pop. You know, you'd have to start there. And you want, when they walk out that door and they're let back into society, they're not going to want to come back to prison. It might make their brain actually stop.
It might actually be a good idea to say to them, this is going to be a really tough experience, as tough as we can make it constitutionally. Chad, thanks for the call. Let's go to Matthew in Gresham. Hey, Matthew, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Thanks, Lars. First-time caller.
Thank you.
I just wanted to address the transportation guy, expanded capacity, congestion pricing, and all that. Anybody who doesn't think expanded capacity is helpful, all they need to do is take a look at the Banfield Freeway about 4 years ago when they added that one lane from Gateway to I-205 so that it would reduce everybody trying to squeeze over at the last minute trying to get to northbound I-205 or to the airport or whatever.
Yeah.
They put in, maybe it was a half a mile, if that, of one extra lane. And it, at first, it made a really big difference. Now, it may not be doing as well now. It's because I-205 is backed up until kingdom come. But it does make a difference. If there's a demand for it, it's gonna help. And I can't think that a bunch of people have moved to Portland all of a sudden because now we've got a little bit better capacity on our freeway. I just don't think that.
No. I guess part of this problem, Matthew, is I hear people saying, don't build more freeways. People will just use them. Well, I could use the same argument on parks. I could say every time you build a new park, people use it. Except my reaction to people using the parks that are there is, isn't that why we built them? We built them so people can use them. So why would you say we don't want to build something if people will use it? Whether it's bigger water pipes, bigger sewer pipes, bigger electric capacity, freeways. I mean, my goodness, you could have much smaller transmission lines throughout America if Americans used, you know, electricity the way that people do in Mexico, where the average home has a couple of light bulbs and a refrigerator. But the average American home has a lot more capacity. But you never hear the BPA or Seattle Electric saying, well, don't build more electric capacity. People will just use it. Because that sounds makes you sound like an idiot. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone call shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. But an interesting new development in the healthcare field, and that is a mega merger. Amazon, J.P. Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway have proposed to put together an entity that will provide either healthcare or health insurance or both to an awful lot of Americans, starting with 900,000 employees of those firms worldwide. I've invited Julius Hobson on, who's a healthcare lobbyist with the law firm of Polzinelli in Washington, D.C., and formerly the head of congressional relations for the American Medical Association. Mr. Hobson, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me what this idea consists of. Is it both health insurance and health care, or is it a merger of the two that's going to be provided for these three big entities?
Well, that's the assumption, that it's a merger of all of the above. They simply put out a statement. But you're looking at Amazon, J.P. Morgan Chase, Berkshire Hathaway combining to try to reduce health care costs with a total employee number of 900,000 people. That's a fairly large entity. It also says that they have a significant part of the market. As you know, Amazon has distribution centers all over the country. They will be able to have a significant impact. Amazon previously had been looking into the drug distribution market with regard to generics and sending out prescription drugs through their system. This will have a significant impact on healthcare delivery once it's up and running.
Mr. Hobson, so they say we're going to start with our own employees, and then there is the potential for them to grow outside of those three huge American companies. And already it's caused a drop, I guess, in some of the other healthcare stocks, as some of the other hospital entities or healthcare entities have reacted to this news. Do they have reason to be concerned that this new entity, like, you know, that's headed up by some innovative people, might actually change, you know, change the direction of healthcare?
Yes, and they should be concerned. If this works for them, then what they will be able to do is expand beyond that. For example, there's been, you know, some speculation or discussion that maybe they would start their own generic drug manufacturing.
Wow!
You do that. As I said, with Amazon, with its distribution centers all over the country, they would be in a position to contract directly with hospital systems. Hospitals tend to own physician practices. They have inpatient and outpatient facilities. All of that would be available to them, and that would make them fairly competitive with other providers in the market. It certainly helps to cut out the middleman, the pharmacy management folks. So if you take, you know, if you wipe them out in that sense, that cuts some of your costs. So the pharmacy benefit managers certainly would be concerned. So this could, you know, once it starts to work, could work very well.
Well, and so if they do this, what's going to tell us whether or not it's going to work? I wanted to go this direction first, Mr. Hobson. This entity they're creating is a nonprofit, even though the three that we've mentioned, Amazon, J.P. Morgan Chase, or J.P. Morgan and Berkshire Hathaway, are three famously capitalistic for-profit enterprises. Some make more money than others, but they're talking about turning over the healthcare to a not-for-profit entity. So they're going to be able to say, we don't even make a profit from this. We just use it to supply a necessity to our employees. But there are already not-for-profit entities out there. Isn't Blue Cross usually a not-for-profit entity in most of the states where it has a presence?
That's correct. But this is an entity that would be almost like a closed panel situation. You know, it's something that wouldn't happen right away. They'd have to stand this thing up, get it running, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 years, they'll be able to determine whether or not they can expand it. if it runs well for their employee, it looks like they can manage health care costs. Let's just say I'm a governor. What's the biggest driver in my budget? Medicaid.
Yep.
If, you know, I may decide maybe I can contract with this entity to manage my Medicaid program. You know, that takes a whole lot of covered patients and moves them over to someplace else. So it can have a significant impact down the road. The question for the pharmacy benefit managers and for other these health insurance companies whose stocks went down today is that they can't wait for all of that to happen. They need to look at their business model and make some decisions about how they intend to operate going down the road before it's too late.
Well, so how does that work, Mr. Hobson? I'm talking to Julius Hobson, by the way, who's the former head of congressional relations for the AMA. How does that work when a for-profit entity that has to be, you know, responsible to its stockholders or its investors, and they have to say, we have to make some money for these people, how do they go about competing with a not-for-profit entity?
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem. Not only a not-for-profit, but one, you know, because they're not looking to make a profit, they can shave their costs, but they're also not looking to make returns to stockholders. So they've got more room to operate. That's what will make them much more competitive with the for-profits. And by the way, yes, Blue Cross Blue Shield is most of them are non-profit, but this still would make them competitive with the Blues, simply because of the volume and because of their reduced costs, because they bring everything in-house. You know, you have a number of employers, I mean, Postinelli does the same thing, that have wellness programs. I'd be willing to bet dollars to donuts that Amazon has the same thing. So you've already got a start. You get your employees into this program, so they've got wellness. You've got contracts with hospitals for outpatient and inpatient, which also gets you physicians. You've got your own prescription drug program using generics. And so you've reduced your costs. You're not negotiating with a pharmacy benefit manager. It's going to reduce some of your costs. Will it cut costs? I've never been one who believes that healthcare costs can be reduced on an annual basis, primarily because healthcare is so personal and people are willing to spend whatever it takes to prolong life.
That's true.
What you can do is reduce the annual increase in healthcare costs. If this works, it would be highly competitive, and it may ultimately do a lot to change the delivery of health care nationwide.
Well, and at this point, Mr. Hobson, we're still in a place where a lot of Obamacare is still part of the law. We've gotten rid of the individual mandate because of the tax plan, but the, you know, a lot of the other mandates, the you must have this in your program, that were so, I think, to a lot of us, I was really angry that the government was telling me I had to have things in my health care plan, whether I wanted them or not. Would this help these three firms work around that to say if we're providing our own insurance, our own, you know, doctor's arrangements and everything else, would they have to follow those same Obamacare mandates with every single plan covering every single thing that was outlined in Obamacare?
Well, this would be akin to self-insurance. So
yeah.
they would be exempt from the Affordable Care Act anyway. And so that would not be an issue for them. What will be, you know, because they're still providing, whether it was or was it not, they would still be providing access to health insurance and health care to all of their employees. And that's 900,000 people worldwide. So, you know, the requirements of the Affordable Care Act don't necessarily mean that much to them. What they're looking at is driving down costs. They could negotiate prices with hospitals that they contract with. They're doing their own drugs, so they don't have to negotiate with a middleman on delivery of drugs. So, you know, that's some reduced cost. Using their wellness programs, they can encourage their employees, don't smoke, exercise, lose weight. This gives them a 360-degree package that can better help them manage their costs. Healthcare costs are usually one of the biggest drivers for corporations as well as for state and local government. This is something that could bring this down. If it works, it will have a significant impact on the delivery of health care.
Mr. Hobson, this is why Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon are so darn rich, and God bless them for it.
Right.
Mr. Hobson, thanks for the time. I very much appreciate it.
Anytime.
Okay, right, that's Julius Hobson with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Your calls at 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It may be that I'll have to bring this one up tomorrow, but I was a little disappointed. You see, I've been a fan of Sheriff Joe Arpaio for a long time, and I was disappointed to see their voters in Maricopa County, Arizona, decide to put him out of office. And now he's running for, he's going to run for Congress. And the thing is, I don't think this is a good idea for Joe because of the time, because of the circumstance, because of his age. But I still admire the man. Well, a nonprofit veterans group in Spokane has now canceled an event that would have featured an appearance by Joe Arpaio. The Spokesman Review says that Arpaio on Sunday tweeted that the March 10th event in Spokane, apparently they've canceled it. They've canceled the event and ended all affiliation with the six-term sheriff of Metro Phoenix. The group's founder, Nick Richardson, says the group decided that Arpaio does not best reflect the views of the group. And he says the group did not want to divide the veterans community and wanted to remain more apolitical. The Spokesman Review then describes Arpaio as an immigration hardliner. Actually, I think he just believes in enforcing the law, who was pardoned after defying a judge's order to stop traffic patrols that targeted illegal aliens. Well, what's wrong with that? I have people say to me, but he broke the law. I said, he told a judge he wasn't going to follow the judge's order to stop enforcing the law. If you're the sheriff of an American county, I don't think you should listen to a judge who tells you to stop enforcing the law. Let's go to Joe in Tacoma. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, this traffic conversation's on my mind. It's amazing to me. Have you ever noticed how when we see these ballot measures for spending for mass transit, how they're always marketed as a solution?
Yep.
But when we see the marketing for, well, first of all, we don't really see anymore the marketing for road expansions. But when they talk about it, they talk about roads as this archaic, unsustainable, method that's just like a money pit is the way that it's described. But it just is mind-numbing to me. Why do we as voters and taxpayers accept these phony engineered sales pitches? You know, I mean, do we not know what the population is in Portland or Seattle? And do we not know what it was 5 and 10 years ago? Can we not project
the
growth of a city?
And Joe, you're on the right track.
Same with the roads?
No, you're on the right track. But here's what's happened. The folks who cover your local news, all right, especially the TV stations, do you think they go out and they will constantly sing the praises of transit agencies, even when, as I pointed out, if you look at you have to adjust. How much has our transit, population grown, the people who take the bus and the train, compared to population growth? If you look at that for Metro Portland and Metro Seattle, use of transit has actually declined. Now, the absolute numbers go up. It'd be like having a paycheck that goes up every year, but if it doesn't go up as fast as inflation, it's actually going down.
Right.
And reporters don't report that.
It's what we're doing with the roads.
Yeah. And then if you were to say, gee, there's a lot of people riding the train and the bus, but 80 or 90% of us still get to school, to work, to where we need to go on an automobile or in an automobile. It would be nice to have reporters pointing that out, but they suck up all the PR stuff from the local transit agencies who hate cars and all they believe in is buses. And I'd ask you this, too, sure. Joe. When they tell you we're going to force you onto the bus or train, they're going to make your commute an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours longer, and they're going to save you a couple of dollars. Are you willing to sell your free time, your spare time that you spend with your family at home or doing your pursuits for a couple of dollars an hour?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And are you familiar with Target Zero in Washington?
Absolutely right. They're good. To try and get the injury rate down to zero.
You are married. How do you do that?
You don't. I'd love to see us.
You take people out of their cars.
Well, The problem is, I don't think you, even if you took 10% of the population out of their cars, how much are you going to reduce accidents? Because you notice,
they're not trying to take 10% of the population out of their cars. They're trying to take 100% of the population out of our cars.
Well, and I got to tell you something right now, Joe. You know that there are times those trains and buses are full to the gills right now, and they're only carrying 3 or 4% or 5% of the population. If they were to double the number of transit commuters from 5% to 10%, they don't have the capacity to do it. So how much would you have to increase the capacity? My math skills say you'd have to increase it 20-fold.
Yeah, dollar for it's just stupid. Have you been to Salt Lake City recently?
Yes, I have.
It's smaller than the Seattle area, I grant you. But have you? I mean, the freeway system there. The freeways are bigger there, first of all.
And you go 80 miles an hour. Joe, let me throw this in. My producer, Carl Sundberg, and I were in Vegas last week, and he was telling his girlfriend on the phone. He said, I'm looking out the window at five lanes of traffic going both directions. And yes, Vegas is smaller, but they have a tremendous amount of traffic, not just local, but people going through the community on their way to other parts of America. And they handle it, and they handle it by building freeways. Joe, thanks a lot. I appreciate the phone call. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show on State of the Union Tuesday.